Welcome to episode 127 of Breakout Culture. I'm Charlotte Metcalf. I'm the associate editor at Country and Town House.
I'm Ed Vasey. I'm the culture editor at Country and Town House. We're delighted this week's episode is being brought to you thanks to the general support of Lomi. Regular listeners will know by now, if they haven't already bought one, that Lomi is the name for a sleek, compact, smart waste appliance that sits on your countertop and turns all that smelly, gunky food waste into nutritious plant food. Listeners will also know that Sir John Layton, the Director General of the Scottish National Galleries, was on the podcast last week and he told us about the Dutch word for food waste. It's prut. So we're delighted that we're creating a bit of a conversation around Lomi on the podcast.
And yes, not least, because aside from being brilliantly functional, Lomi is also very good for the planet, which is in tune with Country and Town House's green credentials and recent B Corp status. Now, turning to today's guest, we did say last week that we were going to be talking to the stone sculptor Emily Young and the painter Francis Hamill, but that episode is now going to be aired next week, closer to the time their exhibitions open. This week instead, we're here to talk about music, in particular the piano, because King's Place in London is about to celebrate the 8th edition of the London Piano Festival. Now, I don't play the piano, even though I spent years learning it at school, and today I hugely regret not having kept it up. I don't know about you, Ed, but didn't Tessa Marchington teach you how to play, I seem to remember?
Yes, I had a few lessons with Tessa, but I didn't sustain it. I was able to play the opening bars to Ode to Joy by the end of it, but it did make me think about... I mean, obviously, I'm one of those people who wished he could play the piano, but I think one of the ways in is to... is to teach people fun tunes to play. I think that's what would really motivate them. I think if you ask people to practice their scales and so on, which is the traditional way, it's very off-putting and very dull. Whereas if you, taught me how to play I'm Still Standing by Elton John and I had three or four party pieces, it would probably get me more interested.
Well, I do absolutely agree with that. I never learned any fun tunes at school. That is true. I learned a lot of scales, which are very boring indeed.
Exactly. That's my point. Anyway, back to the Piano Festival, which begins on Thursday, the 5th of October. It runs till the 8th and is planned to coincide with two huge anniversaries. First, the 150th birth of Rachmaninoff, and second, the centenary of the less well-known, but also hugely significant and groundbreaking Hungarian musician Grigori Ligeti. So we're delighted to welcome to our podcast the festival founders and artistic directors, Katya Apekeshiva and Charles Owen. Hello.
Hello there.
Hi.
Did I get your surname right, Katya?
Yes, well done.
That's impressive, fantastic, isn't it?
Yes, I'm very impressed.
I am impressed. Well, we're absolutely thrilled to have you with us, as it's not often enough we talk about music on this podcast. So we can't wait to hear more about what music lovers have in store. Now, we gather the festival kicks off with a concert devoted to the major two piano works of Rachmaninoff, played by you both. So can you start by telling us about that? And perhaps before you talk about the recital itself, tell us why you think Rachmaninoff continues to have such resonance as a composer and also such a reputation for being so extremely difficult to play.
Have you asked enough questions, Charlotte?
I know, that's about 20 questions, sorry.
Well, we're absolutely thrilled to have this concert and start our festival. And like you said, Rachmaninoff has always been audience's favorite composer. I think his music speaks so directly to the heart and is accessible and obviously very melodic. He has known for his amazing, beautiful, long tunes. And it's quite interesting that he lived for most of his life in 20th century, where there was a lot of quite dissonant music being composed already. And he remained in this old world, if you want, with, you know, sort of really melodic, very easy listening tunes. But at the same time, I wouldn't say it's simple music by all means. That's why it's also, like you rightly said, it's very challenging to play. And of course, as pianists, we adore Rachmaninoff because he was one of the greatest pianists ever as well, as fantastic composer. So his writing is extremely complex and virtuosic and polyphonic. So there are many complexities, but this two piano concert is just thrilling. We're starting with early Rachmaninoff suite, which he wrote as a very young man, through to his last work, the Symphonic Dances, which was written for orchestra as well, and extremely emotional and quite a dark piece with a very different mood. So yes, we're absolutely thrilled about this concert.
Now, I'm very intrigued to know where you both met, because you both have such distinguished careers as performers. And Charles Owen, you are a professor at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama and an ambassador for Steinway. And you were born in Moscow, Katya. I mean, and you both played all over the world and everywhere. How and where did you meet, and how did you come together to put this festival on?
Katya and I first sort of saw each other. She was 12, I was 15. I was a student at the Menuhin School, the Yehudi Menuhin School down in Surrey. And a group came over from Moscow, and they were from the great specialist music school, Gnesin School in Moscow. And they played this amazing recital for us. And so we couldn't speak to each other then at that point. She hadn't learned English and I hadn't yet learned Russian. But fast forward about 10 years, we're both at the Royal College of Music, with the same amazing Russian-Ukrainian teacher, a lady called Irina Zaritskaya. And we became friends. We socialized a lot. We actually used to see each other at parties and at competition finals, basically.
Can I just interrupt you there? It was before I learnt Russian. So you've learnt Russian in pursuit of your art.
Definitely. Yes, I did. I would never have the discipline now. No, I learnt it in my teens. Now in my early 50s, I would never be able to do that, such a thing. Just wouldn't have the patience. But I was obsessed by the language and the music and culture, and also their approach to music making. And then, of course, I started to perform in Russia shortly after that. But Katya and I met in the UK, and our performing together started really by chance at a festival in Moscow. It seems hard to imagine now, doesn't it? But 20 years ago, we were there playing, and it just very gradually developed. We realized that we were compatible musically, pianistically. We also get on extremely well. And we have just grown closer together very organically. We also take long periods away of not playing together as a duo. We have our solo careers, chamber music, teaching concertos. So when we do come together, as we are intensively in this week, because we've also got a concert at the National Gallery sort of straight after with another program, it's a different story. We really treasure that time. We rehearse intensively and we enjoy meals together. We deal with our emails, and then it's back to Rachmaninoff.
So you started this festival at the King's Place in 2016 to celebrate the piano, is that right?
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, we both actually have had connection with King's Place before we started the festival. We both played there separately and together. And this is how the idea came to that this would be a perfect place for our festival, because it's just such a wonderful space with, you know, sort of different cafes, galleries, and just a very spacious, you know, beautiful overlooking canal. And also this area in recent years developed massively, so it became...
Oh, yes.
You know, it used to be probably the area not many people would go to concerts for, but now, you know, people like hanging out in Granary Square and sort of, you know, sort of around there. So we thought, and it has two beautiful Steinway grand pianos, which is essential, obviously, for two piano concerts. And that's how idea started.
I read another really interesting thing you said, that you felt that piano playing was very lonely.
You learn so much from playing together on the same piano, if it's four hands, or two pianos seated opposite. It's very, very inspiring. And when one returns to the solo work, you take something from the other artists you've worked with.
So, excuse my ignorance, but Rachmaninoff wrote his piano pieces for two pianos.
He has two piano suites and symphonic dances, which are written for two pianos, but he also has a set of pieces for four hands. So, you know, it's possible to have both.
How many composers have written for two pianos?
Ah, well, I think it really starts with, I mean, you can go back to someone like Bach, for example, wrote, or Vivaldi, they wrote concertos for, in that case, harpsichords, two harpsichords, three, sometimes four harpsichords. And then Mozart wrote concerto for two pianos. And I think Mozart and Schubert are the first two really, truly great composers to write piano duets. So that is very important that we get the difference. That's two players at one instrument, whereas what we're doing with the Rachmaninoff are two players on two interlocking instruments.
I mean this is a much more sort of probably stereo kind of effect of two pianos. I mean, it's also visually kind of in some ways more dramatic for people to see two grand pianos interlocking and sort of occupying so much of stage. It kind of looks more theatrical, if you wish, and the four hands, two pianists on one piano, is a more intimate, perhaps, you know, genre. Like a lot of Schubert's music was played in famous Schubertiads when he gathered with friends.
The thing about Rachmaninoff's piano music is, I mean, he's a kind of descendant of Chopin and Liszt, if you like, and Tchaikovsky. Without them, he would never have written in the same way. And when you've got two pianos playing together, the richness, obviously you've got the four hands, and the richness of textures, it goes even further than what one player can do on one piano. And that requires tremendous skill in the balancing of sound and the sort of dovetailing of parts and the way we react to each other.
You're also doing a very interesting thing with Lucy Parham and Tim McInerney.
But we are actively only involved in two concerts. We curate the whole 5 days together with the King's Place artistic team. Lucy is doing a very special show with Tim, and she devised, it's basically a sort of mini drama. She plays a selection of pieces by Rachmaninoff, his friend Scriabin, and of course mentor Tchaikovsky. And the actor, because there's a different actor each time she does it, becomes Rachmaninoff and tells the story through his own words, about his childhood, what it was like having to flee the Bolsheviks, his loneliness in America, and trying to be accepted in this very alien culture of the US in the 20s and 30s. And yeah, it's a drama really for piano and an actor.
Yeah, I mean, we've had Lucy Parham do another show before about Clara Schumann. She does amazing shows.
So Rachmaninoff was effectively an exile for all his life, was he?
Not all.
But yeah, probably majority of his life, adult life. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think one really important thing, I've just been reading this fascinating book by Fiona Maddox about Rachmaninoff in exile. She talks particularly about his life in the USA, and of course he lived in France as well. And she just says, you know, after he left Russia, he wrote very, very little music because he had to make his living as one of the world's greatest pianists. He was constantly on tour. And of course, in those days, touring was boats and trains and automobiles. He liked fast cars as well, I may add.
And tell us also then about Ligeti.
Yeah, Ligeti. Well, he is the kind of, in a way you could say, he's like the successor to Bartok in Hungarian music. And so the concert we're doing, we're actually invited two astonishing artists. One is Danny Driver, who has recorded all of Ligeti's legendary etudes. And the other is Claire Hammond, and she's also playing Ligeti and pieces by the Korean composer Eun-suk Chin, who studied with Ligeti. So when he started out, he wrote music that was sort of quite folky Hungarian style, you can relate to Bartok, not so complex. And gradually he evolved into kind of new universes of complexity. I think many people will have encountered Ligeti in the Stanley Kubrick film, The Space Odyssey. Yeah, that's one of the first times his music, in fact, Ligeti himself apparently said that he was in the cinema watching that movie, completely unaware that his own music was about to be heard.
I think this music is truly like another universe, isn't it? I mean, he yes. uses such unique textures and effects, and it's devilishly virtuosic and quite terrifying. I've never done myself any solo piano works by Ligeti, I have to say.
No, me neither. That's why we've invited our friends. I mean, that's a very important thing about London Piano Festival is that when we set it up, obviously we each play something every year and collaborate and play solo, but it's about inviting artists who we admire. And the roster of people we've had playing since 2016 is just breathtaking, I must say. And you have to have not just the chops to do it, but you've got to have a certain kind of brain. And both Danny and Claire, in their respective ways, they untangle this music and they bring it alive with breathtaking imagination.
You've got Vadim Kolodenko.
Vadim Kolodenko is a phenomenal. He won Van Cliburn competition some years ago, and he's just an astonishing virtuoso.
He's going to be playing a quite unusual program, beginning with Handel, which of course originally on the harpsichord, Handel, and then there's early Beethoven, and he's also including some Liszt and piece by Thomas Addis, whose music we've played, and Tom's been part of our festival a few years ago, but also the fact that, you know, Vadim is Ukrainian, we felt that was an important moment to invite him. He's including music by Ukraine's most famous composer, Silvestrov. So that's another little particular twist angle on this year's festival.
I grew up in Moscow, actually. He went to specialist music school. And
It really does emphasize the links between Ukraine and Russia, doesn't it? Terrible tragedy and the kind of porous nature of the relationship.
Yeah.
It is tragic. I believe Vadim's mother lives in Kiev and she doesn't want to leave. So my parents they live in Moscow, and it's a very hard situation with my parents getting older, and me and my sister are based in London, and you know, the traveling there is such a nightmare, and nobody knows when or if the situation will get better anytime soon. So, yeah, it's very hard.
Well, let's move on to a more positive note, which is the Polish jazz pianist Lech Mozda.
Leszek Mozda, who is, well, he's a living legend. He's performed in the festival a few years ago and immediately sort of sold out. And I think they're putting on an extra show this year for demand. And you can. It's one of those people you watch play, you think, my God, this is the effect someone like Liszt would have had back in the 19th century. You know, it's totally spellbinding.
And also he's very funny. He sort of has a certain image, and with his long hair, he goes barefoot on stage, and then he tells these jokes like a stand-up comedian with his heavy Polish accent. It's really, really funny man as well.
And another thing I seem to remember, he likes to sort of add the few implements inside the piano as the concert goes on. I seem to remember some chains rattling and that sort of thing going. He creates tremendous effects. So for his second concert, it's almost sold out. If you can beg, borrow, steal, then it's absolutely worth it. Jazz fans need to be there.
Yeah, well, and he's actually classically trained. So I remember in the concert we heard him do Chopin etude for an encore absolutely brilliantly. So it's just incredible. Artist.
I just want to ask a question generally about the piano, which I'm quite interested in. As flats and houses, you know, especially in this country, have shrunk and got smaller. You know, I mean, I remember when I was a child, it was quite normal to go into somebody's house and see a piano. And it isn't nearly as frequent nowadays. Are you finding that? Are there less pianists coming up through the next generation?
I'll jump in there. Having grown up here, I agree with you. I'm a vicar's son, grew up in Hampshire, and every time we went to tea at any old lady's house, there would always be a Bechstein, either an upright, and Bechstein had a kind of monopoly on pianos over here, sort of early 20th century. I actually think, contrary to what you've just said, Charlotte, I actually think that a lot and lot of people are learning the piano, but they might, the instrument might be a smaller electric keyboard for if it's a youngster learning, maybe tucked away, might not be as clearly on display in someone's home. It's definitely an issue with flats and soundproofing. I mean, that's a whole other conversation.
Well, that's the thing. Neighbors is another issue. It's not just the space.
But I would say that.
guess.
That applies for anyone practicing a musical instrument or indeed singing. There are all sorts of things. I mean, for example, I've one of my pianos is an upright Yamaha, which has a lovely sound, but it has an amazing, you press a pedal, pop on some headphones, and you can work completely silently. So the neighbours don't hear anything, especially when one's learning a piece and repeating it over and over slowly. And I wouldn't want to be the neighbour listening to me practice, so I always think of that, you know.
That's really interesting, but it's a shame in a way you don't have that sense that I remember as a child, you'd go to someone's house and there might be a bit of a sing-song around a piano. There's kind of sadly slightly less of that, or is there not? Are you not finding that?
I agree with you that definitely on that front, that sort of thing doesn't happen so often. But obviously, you know, Katya and I are both professional musicians, and you'd be amazed, professional musicians don't always, when we meet up, want to play. In fact, it's actually considered slightly bad taste. If say you're at a dinner party and someone has a piano in the corner, go, oh, well, you're a concert pianist, so why don't you get up and play something? And I go, and they, well, what do you do? And, oh, I'm a doctor. Well, I've got a problem with my back, so can you help me with that, please? So there is a little bit of that, but recently I was giving a recital and I was staying with such lovely people. Afterwards, I actually sat down and played something at the meal, and that's the first time I have ever done that in my whole life.
Wow, they must have been pretty special. One of my sort of memories of my childhood is I remember my parents and grandparents forcing me to play in front of guests, which I absolutely hated.
I'll tell you where it was, where I played. It was in a beautiful historic place called Winchelsea in East Sussex. I just was so inspired after the concert in this ancient place, and just felt like it was out of time. And then there was this lovely reception and dinner party, and then, yeah, just launched into some Bach at about midnight.
Well, huge good luck with the festival. It sounds absolutely wonderful. And I can just see, I mean, it's a pity listeners can't see you, because the joy on both your faces is quite wonderful to behold. And you both look so young. Obviously, music keeps you very young.
I hope so. Cassie's younger than me, but I mean, we keep fit. I've just been with my personal trainer and, you know, Pilates, all that kind of stuff. And I think, I do think there's something childlike about musicians. That's, there's a famous joke, apparently a young pianist says, you know, I would love to be a musician when I grow up. And Mum says, you have a choice. You either grow up or you be a musician.
Yes, exactly.
And your fingers are insured for millions.
That's a question that musicians get asked so often, Ed. And actually, I remember once looking into it about 30 years ago. And it was kind of the insurance company sort of divides your hand into different bits.
Yeah, it's horrible. Horrible.
So you could,
I remember
you could have,
seeing it.
You know, you could have one finger would cost this much, two fingers for this, and then the whole hand, and then it's not good.
Yeah, it's not nice.
But you presumably do have to have an exercise regime for your fingers.
Well, exercise regime is practicing. and having a balance between rest and practice.
There are these five finger exercises various composers have devised to develop pianist strength and facility. And there's a few of them which I will warm up with by certain composers each morning, just to get everything limbered up. Like say before you do a workout and you've got a slight warm up regime. But I actually wanted to mention a crucial element, especially as the years roll by, is stretching out the arms and hands after playing. Gently stretching is really, really important because the muscles are tight. Also, not getting dehydrated when one's practicing and playing a concert. And so often in the public doesn't see this. We leave the stage between a piece or after a half an hour, whatever piece. It's a quick sip of water. And that can just make the next piece go that little bit better.
I remember meeting Nicola Benedetti, and she has a sort of permanent bruise on her clavicle from obviously playing the violin so much. I mean,
yeah, of course.
Do you have immensely strong fingers?
Yes, absolutely. And I can say that I can say there are times when my partner goes, Just let go. Your hands are too strong. I think sometimes one forgets how strong our hands are, especially when one's playing a piece like Rachmaninoff. Your fingers just develop so much because The hand has to be flexible, strong, and very, very sensitive, the fingertips. There was a famous Russian professor who once said, you know, a pianist's soul is located in their fingertips.
Absolutely. Always. I remember my teacher nagging me always, forever, but fingertips, that all your... Again, the technique is that your body is supposed to be quite relaxed, but your strength, all strength goes in your fingertips. And that can take years to teach somebody to feel that.
Absolutely. Because the wrong way around, just being technical for a moment, would be to have sort of soggy or sort of like overcooked pasta fingers and a tense body. You want the reverse. You want relaxed upper body and arms, strong core and fingertips full of energy and strength.
Well, there you go. I mean, I've got the title for your book now: Soggy Body, Firm Fingers.
And Soul. And Soul.
Yes, exactly.
Doesn't sound very appealing somehow.
It doesn't. I love it.
Oh, well, thank you both so much. That was absolutely fascinating. And have a wonderful time.
Our pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Now, before we go, there's a lot going on in the art world at the moment. If you haven't been already, the major exhibition of Marina Abramović's work is at the Royal Academy, and it's not to be missed. It really does cement her role as the most outstanding, original and courageous performance artist. And this exhibition features a lot of photographs and video of her early work that she performed with her longtime partner, Ule, who died of cancer in 2020. There's also the footage of them walking towards each other along the Great Wall of China to say goodbye to each other, which is incredibly moving, and much, much more. It really is extraordinary. Have you seen it, Ed?
I haven't been. I was invited to the opening, which I couldn't go to, which was very annoying. Without wishing to demean performance artists, there are a couple of Instagrammable moments I've noticed, because everybody is posting the same Instagram photo. There's one of a doorway which seems to be framed by postcards, and dare I say it, I think occasionally framed by two nude people that you have to squeeze through.
No, it was very funny because there are two nude people and they're imitating what Ule and Marina did years ago, where people really did have to push through them to get in. But it was very interesting watching people go around the room, because people were avoiding that doorway quite a long time, as was I.
Can you squeeze through them should you choose to do so?
You can, but there is a way slinking around to the side of them should you be squeamish about doing so.
No, I'm definitely squeezing through.
I bet you are.
No question.
Anyway, tell us what else is on, because given you're on the board of the Tate, you know, tell us about Sarah Lucas's new show that's coming up.
Well, by the time this podcast comes out, I will have been to the Sarah Lucas show, because it opens on the Tuesday before this podcast. But I haven't been yet. It's got fantastic reviews. She's obviously one of the leading artists of the Brit art movement that broke in the 90s. She's now of a certain age, but she was an enfant. I think she's about 60 now. She was an enfant terrible at the time. Lots of incorporation of popular culture and sculptures made out of stuffed tights and so on. So it's going to be another sensational exhibition. I'm very happy. I think it's her first major retrospective. I'm very happy to see it, Tate, and I think it will be astonishingly popular.
It's also 50 years since Picasso died, and Almin Rec, who's married to Picasso's grandson, has galleries all over the world, including one in London, which has a show opening on Tuesday, the 10th of October, to celebrate Picasso's enduring inspiration on modern and contemporary artists. The show, Celebrating Picasso Today, Infinite Modernism, has works by numerous artists, many specially commissioned, which represent how they respond to Picasso's work. The show also includes some never-before-seen works by the American artist Peter Halley, which he painted 40 years ago, also inspired by Picasso, obviously. So that's going to be a fascinating show at the Almin Rec.
I like the way you say Picasso.
Do I? Picasso.
You say Picasso and I say Picasso.
Picasso.
I like that. Anyway, just before we let you go, it's Bookshop Day on Saturday the 14th of October. There are going to be events for all ages at bookshops across the country. Authors such as Chris Van Tulliken, he's the doctor, isn't he? A.F. Stedman, Catherine Rundell, she's the new Philip Pullman, Cressida Cowell, who I was at Oxford with, and many more. So don't fail to check out your local bookshop to see what's going on. Once again, many thanks to Lomi for supporting us, and please don't fail to take advantage of this wonderful offer. You get 50 quid off a Lomi of your very own. You go to Lomi's website at uk.lomi.com and you use the promo code BREAKOUT at the checkout. Next week, we're talking to Britain's leading female stone sculptor, Emily Young, and Francis Hamill, the landscape and portrait artist, about his new paintings of gardens. Both have exhibitions opening in the West End in October, so don't fail to tune in then.
Have a very good weekend and see you next week. Goodbye.